I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome today. Don't even know my own name sometimes. Urbanite Radio stories on the Mark Steiner Show are made possible by Baltimore Mediation, the first mediation firm in the state of Maryland, specializing in separation and divorce and business and workplace conflicts right here in Baltimore. Just go to www.baltimoremediation.com. As I said at the very top of the hour, there's a man in American history who I knew nothing about and most Americans knew nothing about, but who had a profound effect on American thought, on black thought, on the thought of the left in this country, and has seemed to be wiped out of American history, was brought back in the first volume of this two-volume biography called Hubert Harrison, The Voice of Harlem Radicalism, 1883 to 1918, written by Jeffrey Perry. Jeffrey Perry joins us now by phone, and welcome. Good to have you with us.
Hi, Mark. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure.
This is amazing. I mean, I always kind of pride myself of being a student of American, especially radical history and African-American history. And then all of a sudden this book popped across that someone sent to me and told me about you, and I never heard of him. America doesn't know about this man, Hubert Harrison. Give us a quick thumbnail sketch.
Very briefly, he lives from 1883 to 1927. He's born in St. Croix in the Virgin Islands and comes to the United States in 1900 as a 17-year-old orphan. He dies in 1900. J.A. Rogers in World's Great Men of Color describes him as the foremost Afro-American intellect of his era. A. Philip Randolph calls him the father of Harlem radicalism. He is the major radical influence on both A. Philip Randolph and Marcus Garvey. When I grow up, yeah, that's Malcolm and Martin, right?
Right.
That's that. And he really, he's a brilliant writer. We've located about 700 of his writings, a soapbox orator, and he has a lot that really resonates with audiences today, particularly when he talks on race, class, and war, right? And so the book, the book's been out. It's been out about 11 months. It's in its fourth printing already. And
really?
It's really a bottom-up effort. Yeah, it's very exciting. And we've done, I have a little slide presentation. I was in Baltimore. That's how I was first, I first learned of your show. People were raving about your show. They said, oh, right to Mark Steiner. And it was at Red Emma's bookstore. But
oh, yeah.
I had been in touch with a host of people in and around Baltimore. People, Rosalyn Terborg Penn at Morgan and Paul Coates from Black Classic Press. And Felicia Pride, one of your local authors down there,
yes.
Who's just got a new book out. I mean, just a lot of people have started to show, well, some knew of Harrison, of course, but people are really showing interest. So it's all very exciting right now. And as you indicated, this is the first of a two-volume biography.
Commitment. It was an amazing human being. I mean, I let's just talk a bit about him. I mean, because his intellect and wisdom crossed so many boundaries. The literary criticism, the backing of a black drama, an African-American drama in Harlem, a socialist party. I mean, it was just amazing what this man did and who he was. And I mean, just I'm stuttering almost because I'm flabbergasted by the power this man had and the effect he had on people's minds in the early part of the 20th century.
Just to pick up on a couple of those themes. As an intellectual, I mean, what's really striking also is Harrison is an autodidact. He's self-educated. He never went to college a day in his life. But shortly after he arrived, he was working, you know, as so often happens with immigrants, right? They come, he's working 5 days a week and a couple nights, and he's in his teens, and he gets citywide honors in three subjects in New York, and they headline Genius Found in West Indian Student. He spoke or read six languages. He read all the time. We were able to track down his papers. His family, when I started, this is 28 years work, right? And when I started work on it back in the 80s, his children were still alive, and they had preserved on an apartment on 150th Street in Manhattan, in Harlem, his papers from when he died in 1927. And it's a major collection. It's now been placed at Columbia University. But so he read. When he died, it was said he read as many as six books a day. I think, I take that with a little bit of leeway. But I've gone through his books, and he did know how to attack books and wide ranging his clippings, his collection. And he would lecture. He pioneered the tradition of soapbox oratory, and he would lecture on history, science, politics, education, literature, religion, evolution, sexual relations. He, you know, just very extraordinarily wide-ranging. Also, just as the intellectual Harrison, we've located 700 pieces that he wrote. So he's prolific. You know, he dies at 44. As an editor, he edited The Masses, which was the leading left literary publication of the decade between 1910 and 20.
That's amazing.
He edits The Voice, the first paper of the New Negro Movement. Then he edits a publication called The New Negro in 1919. This is 6 years before Alain Locke. The Voice is 8 years before Alain Locke, right? And then he edits the Negro World, Garvey's paper. As a critic, as you mentioned, Eugene O'Neill, who wins the Nobel Prize for Literature after Harrison does a review of Emperor Jones, says it's the finest piece he's seen, and Harrison has a role in any theater. And just one last thing.
Go on.
As a book reviewer, he is the first regular black book reviewer in history. We've located 68 to 70 reviews, and he's so relevant. When he's working in the post office at age 24, he has two front page pieces. It used to be the New York Times Saturday review of books. Now it's the Sunday. Two front page pieces on the New York Times Saturday review of books, the front page. And most recently, we have two wonderful book critics, a fellow named Scott McLemy from D.C. who writes for Inside Higher Ed, and Eric Bank. They're two of the National Executive Board members of the National Book Critics Circle, and they both independently have quotes from Hubert Harrison on their webpage on how to review books. I mean, this is extraordinary, you know.
And again, we reiterate that we're talking about a black man in America. He immigrated here at 17 in 1900. Do I have that right? Was it 1900?
Correct.
At 1900 from what's now the Virgin Islands.
Yes.
And just taught himself and became, I mean, the fact that a black man had his works in the New York Times in the early part of the 20th century is mind-boggling by itself.
At least 10 letters published. I mean, quality pieces.
But what you said, I think that the I want to explore for a minute kind of the...
Sure.
The import of his life in terms of his effect on people as politically diverse as Marcus Garvey and mm-hmm. A. Philip Randolph. A. Philip Randolph, for folks who don't know, was the head of the Pullman Porters. He spanned the entire 20th century. Mm-hmm. He was the man who, part of the March on Washington in 1963, he was the one man among all the civil rights leaders who stood up for gay Americans and Bayard Rustin. I mean, he's an amazing figure in American history. And Marcus Garvey, who most people know, is the leader to one of the most powerful movements around race in America. But he influenced both of these men in a deep
Correct.
And profound ways.
Right. Harrison is the only person in United States history to play signal leading roles in the largest class radical movement of his era and the largest race radical movement. He was the leading black theoretician, agitator, and organizer in the Socialist Party around 1912.
With Eugene Debs.
Yeah, campaigning for Debs, speaking as many as 23 times a week, morning, noon, and night. He's all over, right? And he wrote all the first major theoretical pieces on socialism and the Negro, which we can perhaps talk about. Then when he finally leaves the Socialist Party, it's over white supremacy, but Harrison defines himself as a radical internationalist. And when I say it's over white supremacy, it's not simply towards black people. It's also towards Asians, because at the 1912 convention, before the 1912 Socialist Party convention, he essentially laid out the question before the party goes, Southernism or socialism, what's it going to be? And then in that convention, there was some very heated, they didn't really even discuss what was called in those days the Negro question, but they had a lot of debate on Asian immigration and some of the most racist pronouncements in the history of the left, you know, about a white man's party and this and that, and majority and minority positions, essentially arguing racism is innate, you know, and class cuts could be learned, but racism is innate. So Harrison winds up leaving the Socialist Party and founds the New Negro Movement, out of which grows the Garvey Movement. Now, Randolph is a follower of Harrison in this early period, and of course, Randolph continues to get attracted to socialism. When Harrison founds the New Negro Movement, this story, and most people are not familiar with this, when Marcus Garvey comes to the United States, he's actually a follower of Booker T. Washington, who has a much more conservative philosophy. And Marcus Garvey comes from Jamaica. He's prepared to go back home when a friend of his from his youth, a fellow named W.A. Domingo, who's in Harrison's organization, brings Garvey to see Harrison, and he sees the appeal that Harrison has on a soapbox and the race-conscious message he's putting out. Because this is what Harrison's when this is after Harrison starts concentrating work in the black community, and Garvey decides to stay. He joins Harrison's organization. Now, people familiar with Marcus Garvey know he's not usually one. He's not one to join anyone else's organization. You know, he really wanted to head his own organization. And so, by the accounts of numerous contemporaries, and in case of Randolph, by his own words, but Harrison is the major radical influence on each of these outstanding figures, these major figures in black history, right? And in the book, if I can just say on the book, the book, volume one, runs over 600 pages, got 110 pages of notes, so this is serious research.
You're a very thorough scholar, that's clear.
The index is 76 pages, what we call broad and deep. You look up women, you're getting categories and subcategories, you don't get strings and numbers. It's meant to stand the test of time. So when I make these statements here on the air, I can assure you, everything's documented very carefully in the book because, you know, it's important. I mean, to come, as we're coming with such a new analysis and emphasizing the importance of Harrison, it's got to be backed up, you know, and of course we try to do that.
And you've done that. I mean, there's so much I want to talk about here, and I want to even go beyond your first volume. There's enough to talk about just in the first volume, but the things he did beyond that are just as amazing. I know you're writing a second volume, right?
Yes. Most of it's laid out. I'm shooting for 2012 with that. Now, just on this first volume, it's been out 11 months. We've done probably 110 or 120 talks, right? Last week we were in Chicago and L.A. Harrison's grandson is out, you know, speaking with me. And, I mean, it's just every place we go, people are just fascinated by Harrison, and they really want to learn more, particularly the younger generation, because he's got a little of the Malcolm in him. You know, he speaks straight and true, and he analyzes so well, and that's part of his appeal. You know, he's not playing games. He comes right at it, you know? And so, yeah, we've got, very wonderful response so far.
And we have to take a break here to sure. go into our fundraising, but I want the folks, when we come back from this, we're also going to explore his effect on the Harlem Renaissance, which is not in this book necessarily, which I think is a really important piece to understand, and his critique there, why he took on Du Bois.
Uh-huh.
We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about things you may not have known about Harlem, and in 1912, how a huge percentage of Harlemites voted for the Socialist Party because of the work of Hubert Harrison and his going with the Wobblies even after that. Ton to talk about. So we're introducing you to a new man for most of us to understand who's had a profound effect, not just in the African-American world, but in the American world, whose name was Hubert Harrison. And we're talking to Jeffrey B. Perry. Dr. Perry is the man who wrote the book, Hubert Harrison, The Voice of of Harlem Radicalism, 1883 to 1918. Remind you as we go into this pitch break, the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. Welcome back. Urbanite Radio stories on the Mark Steiner Show are made possible by Maren Alsop and the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra, presenting its 2009-2010 season featuring Kathleen Battle, Andre Watts, Yitzhak Perlman, and more. Tickets to the Meyerhoff available at 410-783-8000 or go to bsmusic.org. We are talking this hour with Jeffrey Perry, who is author of the book Hubert Harrison, The Voice of Harlem Radicalism, 1883 to 1918. Lines are open, 410-319-8888, to make your comments here on the air with us as well. Jeffrey, I want to jump right into this, but I mean, I just like the people to know a little bit about you just for a second, but there's so much to talk about with Hubert Harrison. I know that you're a very modest man, but from everything people have told me, but that you are a scholar, a serious scholar, but you're also been a union official. You've been a fighter for workers' rights, at the same time that you've been doing all this work as a teacher and a scholar. So you mean your activism is like you were born to do this Hubert Harrison thing.
Well, actually, I had to learn. But, I'm a product of the 60s, I think, essentially. And I was influenced by the civil rights struggle, black liberation struggle, and anti-war. Of course, those movements were catalysts for everything else, for the student movement, the anti-war movement. And I learned those lessons. I had a very good teacher, by the way, a fellow named Theodore W. Allen, who your listeners might also want to know about, because he did a lot of work. He did 25 years work in colonial Virginia and Eastern Shore, Maryland, and has written two wonderful volumes on the invention of the white race. If people go to website, mm-hmm. www.jeffreybperry.net, they'll find lots of information on Harrison and on Allen, but including free articles that he's written, you know, things like that. They can really probe around and get lots of information. So while they're listening, if they happen to be near their computer, www.jeffreybperry.net, and they can, you know, pick up a little information, something might spark their interest. They might want to ask a question.
So let's talk a bit about some of the things we raised before we went to break about Hubert Harrison. You, when I was reading in the book, where did I put my copy of the book? There it is. Here we go. I can't remember which tab is which, but when you were writing in here about his work in Harlem during the 1912 election,
right?
And the fact that here it is, I found it, is that the high percentage of African Americans, like a quarter of the vote, went to the socialist candidate for mayor out of the Harlem votes. I mean, this mm-hmm. and this was Hubert Harrison's organizing,
right? And this was a major break because up until that time, the black community was generally tied to the Republican Party because it was the party of Lincoln and Reconstruction and Emancipation, and Frederick Douglass' famous quote about the Republican Party is the ship, all else is the sea. And Harrison tried to encourage more political independence in the black community and actually then encourage them towards socialism. And he did so by delivering lectures on Lincoln, as a matter of fact. That was one of the things he did between 1911 and 24. And he emphasized Lincoln, you know, that Lincoln had done some good things, but people should not just be blindly loyal to Lincoln. And they, you know, and then he'd comment on some quotes that Lincoln made during the course of his lifetime, you know, comments on maintaining slavery if necessary, on some of his views at different points in his life on black capabilities. And what's interesting about that is Harrison does that lecture from 1911 to 24. In 2000, Lerone Bennett Jr., who's a senior editor of Ebony, does a book along a similar vein and really gets kind of raked over the coals by a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And then most recently, a year ago, Henry Louis Gates does a similar book and gets a, you know, better treatment than Bennett had. But in neither case did they refer back to Harrison. It's one of many ways where Harrison kind of leads or precurses things, and but people, you know, not always aware of what he did and his influence.
Well, one of the things, let me just jump ahead a little bit here.
Sure.
Why do you think that he was lost? I mean, you've written about how he was a friend of Schoenberg's.
Right.
That they were colleagues together in that library on 135th Street. He helped build that library, and his portrait was there, and then it mm-hmm. disappeared.
Right.
And his grave had that picture. It wasn't that of his grave. It was unmarked.
Shared.
So what happened? Why do you think he was lost to history like this?
Okay, very briefly. First off, he's not better known because he is black, he's poor, he's working class, he's an immigrant, he's from the Caribbean. These are all groups that have been underrepresented historically, right? He's a radical on class, race, and religion. He breaks from the church, he turns to free thought, scientific analysis of society's problems, and of course the church is the most powerful institution in the black community. He's a very forthright critic. This is in his first decade in New York. He's nurtured in these very vibrant black working class intellectual circles where freewheeling debate and discussion is the norm, and people are really encouraged to speak to them. It's the kind of environment that we want to encourage today, you know, where people really, you know, air their differences, but not mean-spirited, and then they go out and have a drink or something afterwards. He had no long-lasting organizational ties, so he didn't have an organization that would preserve his memory for years afterwards. He dies young at 44, and he's not martyred like Malcolm or Martin, and he doesn't live 50 more years like Du Bois. But overall, when I go through all those, the two things that really stand out, I think, are, in some ways, it's not surprising to me because he was such a clear-thinking radical. This is a very powerful country, and it's not surprising to me in some ways that somebody like Harrison doesn't get the full attention he merits, you know, because there's a lot of forces at play. Even when there was the renewed interest in black studies in the late 60s, by some, I mean, many people were interested for years and years, but when there's that renewed interest and all of a sudden there's publications coming out, some of the publishing houses and stuff, there's other figures that it's a little easy to turn to. They're a little more palatable. And Harrison speaks true. The other thing, Rogers explains, J.A. Rogers in World Greats Men of Color says it's Harrison's candor. And Hodge Kiernan, who was a contemporary of Harrison, a fellow from Montserrat, another brilliant activist of his generation, points out 3 months after Harrison dies, and this gets exactly to what you were speaking about, he goes, he does a little piece in one of the publications of that period. This is in February. Harrison dies in December of 27. This is February of 1928. And he talks about how the Messenger, the Journal of Scientific Radicalism, has not said a word about Harrison. The Crisis, the NAACP's publication, does pay, you know, a big feature on the death of Boxer Tiger Flowers, but says nothing about Harrison. How Opportunity, the Urban League's publication, and then Kiernan says, this concerted silence is ominous. It does appear that there is something wrong somewhere. So what we have is, and I mean, this is one example, but we have from the left, from labor, from many black leaders, we have people who you would think would keep Harrison's name alive for various reasons don't speak about him, oftentimes because they've been criticized, you know, by him quite openly and publicly. I mean,
Joe, we have to take a very brief break and come right back. Sure. And I want to explore with you a couple of things. One is that when we look at early American history, early 20th century history in the black world, we always talk about the break between Booker T. Washington and William Du Bois, but this he played a different role in all of this and a very critical role. We want to explore that, and let's jump ahead of your book a little bit and talk a little about the Harlem Renaissance and why Hubert Harrison didn't even like the name Harlem Renaissance and what his literary criticism said about all that. So you have to wait for that. We'll come back with Jeffrey Perry to talk about Hubert Harrison, the voice of Harlem radicalism, 1883 to 1918, and a very important book. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite, Baltimore's monthly magazine of ideas and innovation. This month, Urbanite explains a new movement in architecture and design, debates the downsizing of Baltimore City, and offers an in-depth look behind the state's biggest transportation project. It's the Building Issue, available at over 800 locations. Visit www.urbanitebaltimore.com for a list of drop locations. We are talking right now with Jeffrey Perry, author of the book, Hubert Harrison, The Voice of Harlem Radicalism, 1883 to 1918. Our number here is 410-319-8888. Jeffrey, let's explore what I left off with you as we're going to break. We all know in our history of Booker T. Washington and William Du Bois and the split between them and how that's always been talked about as the fundamental views in the black world about how to confront racism. But Hubert Harrison played a different role in that and had critiques of both men.
Right, and he's reshaping our study. It's no longer going to simply be the Booker T. Washington-Du Bois debate, I don't think, because Harrison now brings a radical, articulate, working-class voice, an immigrant voice, a Caribbean voice. Specifically, what happens is when he criticized Booker T. Washington in 1910, Booker T. Washington's the most powerful black leader in the country, when he goes to London and Denmark and issue some statements essentially saying things are fine back home. This is in 1910 when lynching, segregation, and disfranchisement mar the land. Du Bois puts together a protest group of about 40, but Harrison, who's working in the post office, writes a couple letters, and Booker T. Washington has him summarily fired from the post office. That's a devastating blow because at the time Harrison and his wife have two children. She's pregnant with a third, and essentially for the remainder of his life he lives in poverty. Now, with Booker, with Du Bois, the differences develop over time because Harrison starts out and considers himself a Du Bois man in that debate between Du Bois and Booker T. You know, he's siding with Du Bois. But when the NAACP, this is the 100th anniversary of the NAACP, and when it's founded, Harrison puts forth some, you know, cautionary notes, essentially arguing that the NAACP should not be limited by white people's views of how black people should act. Mm-hmm. He gets very specific about this. And he early articulates the concern that the NAACP has no answer to what happens if those white minds at which you are aiming remain unaffected. And one of the key places that this works plays itself out in that first decade is on the question of lynching, because Harrison is a strong proponent of federal anti-lynching legislation. And most people associate the NAACP with anti-lynching work, but they don't know that for its first decade plus, it refused to support federal anti-lynching legislation. And why? It was the exact reason that Harrison had warned about, according to various historians whom I cite, they didn't want to alienate Southern white support. And again, why is federal anti-lynching legislation important? Because particularly down south in those, you know, towns and states, if you leave it to local authorities, little chance you're going to get justice. With the federal, in, you know, federal legislation, there's a chance with federal intervention you get some justice, right? So that was a big issue. And Harrison's also developed criticisms of Du Bois on the question of the talented tenth, which most people associate with Du Bois, the notion that the educated and gifted must be made leaders of thought and missionaries of culture among the people, right? And Harrison felt, and Harrison's a man of the common people. When he lives in Harlem, he's living on the most densely populated block in the community. He is in and amongst the people. He is not on high. He's not aloof, right? And so he thought that the talented tenth, as articulated by Du Bois, hadn't provided the leadership that was needed, that they should come down from the Mount Sinai and get amongst the people. And he also gets into a criticism of what the colored leadership implicit in much of what was considered the talented tenth notion implied. What the big difference with Harrison and Du Bois works its way out, and it's the end of this first volume, during World War One. Harrison's a strong critic of World War One, and he and William Monroe Trotter, one of the giants of the early 20th century black protest leaders, co-founder with Du Bois of the Niagara Movement, and a, you know, strong opponent of Booker T. Washington, they decide to convene a Liberty Congress to meet in Washington, D.C. in the last week of June of 1918, and it's going to demand enforcement of the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment, federal anti-lynching legislation, and, you know, it's going to push these demands during wartime. A. Philip Randolph, by the way, is watching Harrison, and during World War II, it is Randolph who leads the March on Washington movement, and during the Vietnam War, leads the March on Washington, understanding that, you know, when it's a war, one of Harrison's principal demands with his Liberty League and the Liberty Congress, Woodrow Wilson's calling on Americans to make the world safe for democracy. Harrison says, let's make the South safe for democracy. And again, he's got, I mean, similar quotes, you know, in terms of today's, you know, efforts, particularly under George W. Bush. But so what happens with the Liberty Congress is Jolie Spingarn, who's the head of the NAACP, and who's the man that to this day the NAACP gives their award for outstanding achievement by a black American, is also a major in military intelligence. That's that branch of the War Department that monitors the black and the radical community. And by Du Bois's own account, he's Du Bois's closest white friend. So Spingarn comes up with a plan to undermine the Liberty Congress that's being organized by Harrison and Trotter. The Liberty Congress does convene. It has men and women. I emphasize that because what gets thrown up in opposition has no women from 35 states, and they have that major protest meeting. But in order to undermine it, first Spingarn talks to Trotter and asks him to call off the Liberty Congress. He says no, and then Spingarn comes up with the idea to convene a conference to meet the week week before the Liberty Congress, Colored Editors Conference, right? And he enlists Du Bois in the effort. Now, this is when the rupture really comes between Harrison and Du Bois, because what happens is Du Bois goes along with Stingarn's lead, but he does more. He puts in an application, and this most people who are familiar with Du Bois's history don't know. Du Bois puts in an application for a captaincy in military intelligence. That's that branch of the War Department that monitors the black and the radical community. And as part of the quid pro quo to get the captaincy, he writes an editorial entitled Close Ranks. It's in July 1918, Crisis Magazine. It's probably the editorial he's most ashamed of his entire life, because it opens up and says, while this war lasts, let us forget our special grievances and close ranks behind the war effort. What are the special grievances? Lynching, segregation, disfranchisement. Du Bois himself had defined them 3 months earlier in the publication, right? All the young militants knew what the special grievances were, and Harrison thought this was not a position. Booker T. Washington had died, and everyone was looking for Du Bois to be the national leader, and Harrison leads in the criticism. He says, you cannot, take this position. This is a wrong position. And he ties it into the captaincy. He writes an article, The Descent of Dr. Du Bois. All the young radicals, Randolph, Owen, Garvey, Cyril Briggs, they're all following Harrison's lead on this. And Du Bois is very significantly discredited. What Du Bois's response, whereas Booker T.'s response was to have Harrison fired through the efforts of his Tuskegee machine, his political machine, Du Bois's response was never to mention Harrison, right? Never. Professor Irma Watkins Owen teaches up at Fordham University, and in her book on Caribbean Americans, she makes that point, very clearly, that Du Bois, his approach to Harrison was never to mention him, right?
I will, before we go to break here, I want to read this quote you have just about that period you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
It's on page 370 of your book.
Okay.
Do you want to read it? Want me to read it?
Let me see if I can get to it quickly. It's page 370.
Yeah, at the very bottom of the page, it kind of highlights what you were saying here.
Okay, one second. I'm almost there. Let's see. All right. Excuse me, Mark. I'm sorry.
It's all right, man. We've got about 30 seconds.
Okay.
Left,
we're
all right
here. We go.
Go ahead.
Where do you want me to begin?
Until the white men.
Okay, until the white men. As Harrison described in his diary, until the white men of this country can put patriotism ahead of race, I shall not. So long as they will treat us as niggers rather than as fellow citizens, will those of us who respect themselves keep from fighting for a damn Jim Crow democracy whose tangled threads of hypocrisy, cant, and cruelty will weave their dangerous web across the nation's path to self-respect.
Yeah. And on that note, we'll take a very brief break and come right back to have more of our conversation with Jeffrey B. Perry about his incredible book, Hubert Harrison, The Voice of Harlem Radicalism, 1883 to 1918. Stay with us. We have a little business to do to make sure we keep programs like this and the rest of the stuff on WEAA on the air. Welcome back. We are talking with Jeffrey B. Perry. Dr. Perry is the author of Hubert Harrison, The Voice of Harlem Radicalism, 1883 to 1918, bringing this legacy of this great American back to all of us. And I think there's a call, actually. We're using the same line for pledges we are for phone calls, Jeffrey. So I'm going to take a call here so we can ask you a question. Is that okay?
Sure.
410-319-8888 and Will in Baltimore. You're on the air.
Yeah, thanks so much. I love the topic. I love the new scholarship on Harrison, and I was just wondering, what is the correlation between the Pan-Africanist movement? I know a lot of folks know about that with Garvey, but since Harrison was from the Caribbean as well, I was wondering if there was an influence on Pan-Africanism, and if because of Pan-Africanism, Harrison is known better outside the U.S. than here. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you so much, Will. Jeffrey?
Well, Harrison is not nearly as well known as he should be any place, although that is changing very rapidly. But in terms of just general Pan-Africanism, Harrison, as I emphasized, was an extraordinary internationalist. And so he's in touch with a lot of international leaders of his day. He, in the Negro World, in Garvey's paper, when Harrison takes over the editorship in 1920, that's when it really sweeps the globe. And Harrison initiates things like the West Indian News Notes column. He also writes on Africa. Harrison writes and speaks very knowledgeably on Africa. And the historian Winston James, who's written a wonderful book, Holding Aloft the Banner of Ethiopia, about early 20th century Caribbean radicalism in the U.S., points out that amongst his contemporaries, Harrison probably knew more and spoke and wrote more knowledgeably than any of his contemporaries on Africa, but he did so without the arrogance that so often comes from people in, from this country towards people from Africa. Mark, if I may, just one other thing I wanted to emphasize. In terms of Harrison's importance, J.A. Rogers, in World's Great Men of Color, describes him as the foremost Afro-American intellect of his era. That's amidst chapters on Booker T. Washington, Du Bois, Trotter, and Garvey. And in terms of this publication, it is the first multi-volume biography of an Afro-Caribbean and only the fifth of an African-American, the others being giants of black history, Booker T. Washington, Du Bois, what was previously mentioned, Langston Hughes, and Martin Luther King Jr. So Columbia University Press, and overall, I mean, just every... all people in and around this effort are really treating Harrison as a giant, as a major figure in our history.
Let's talk a bit about a couple things before we run out of time completely, because I don't think how much time I have left, just a few minutes. And he, because this is a world-class intellectual. This is one of the leading, this may be one of the leading public intellectuals of his day.
Correct.
And he was also a great literary figure. I mean, he loved the arts. He was also a free thinker.
Right.
I mean, he was part of the kind of the movement around Francisco Ferrer and his schools and the modern thinking of schools, and there were so many areas that he touched beyond politics.
All the leading currents of his day, correct.
That's something too that's just kind of very amazing about this guy. I mean, you have a great picture in this book of Big Bill Haywood and Helen Gurley Flynn, the leaders of the Wobblies, sitting with Hubert Harrison. That's a pretty amazing picture.
At the Patterson Strike, not far from where I live, we're going to be doing a presentation out there. They still the place where he spoke, the Botto House, is now called the American Labor Museum, and we'll be talking out there in another month or two. A couple years back, they did a rendition of Harrison speaking to the crowd because his talks were considered the most militant of the strike. He was quite a figure, you know.
I mean, did you know about him? Did you know about Hubert Harrison? Before you started this book?
No, I was prepared for Harrison through my contact with Theodore W. Allen, who I mentioned before, who was another autodidact, right? And a very brilliant anti-white supremacist working class intellectual, right? But what happens is I set out, I'm in charge, I'm the union head of the mail handlers union, postal union. I did 33 years in the post office. I'm a product of the 60s who tried to put into practice his beliefs. And I'm working in the post office. I'm the union head at a 4,000 worker postal facility while I'm trying to get my PhD at Columbia University.
I love it. That's great.
Under Nathan Huggins and Hollis Lynch and Eric Foner is one of my dissertation
readers. Oh, really?
Chelsea Hamilton, who writes Black. I mean, these are some major figures, Elliot Skin. So I'm writing on Harrison. But the way I came to Harrison, I set out, see, because I'm very clear, and in my work, I always try and raise the question of how do we struggle against white supremacy, because I believe that white supremacy is the principal retardant to efforts at social change in this country.
Amen
and
to that.
If we want serious social change, we've got to deal with this issue. So I was coming from that perspective, and I was actually looking at all the left and progressive groups from the turn of the 20th century, how they had dealt with efforts to struggle against white supremacy, to see what could be learned. And in the course of that research, I came across Harrison's two books, The Negro and the Nation and When Africa Awakes, both of which, by the way, I'm going to put in a plug here, I think are reprinted by Black Classics Press out of Baltimore, so people can get it locally, right? And those books were available at the time only on microfilm at that Schomburg Center, the New York Public Library, which Harrison helped to build, right? And so I made copies of those books, and I read them. And once I did, I dropped everything because he was without a doubt the clearest thinker I had seen on questions of race and class amongst his contemporaries. And I'm not the only one. I mentioned earlier Winston James, a former Columbia professor now at UCal Irvine, excellent historian. And we're friends, and we speak, and he says, Jeff, I had the exact same reaction. You read Harrison, and he's head and shoulders above his contemporaries. I mean, he really sees with a clarity. And even that, you know, as I probe deeper, there's a nice historian writes a lot about history of anthropology, a fellow named George Stocking. But he says something that I think is insightful, that, you know, it's possible that the autodidact sometimes sees things with a clarity, sometimes others don't, you know, because they pursue, they don't get caught up in a lot of the other stuff, and they understand what's going on in their age and their period very much. So Harrison is during World War One and is a developing national and racial consciousness because of a war to make the world safe for democracy when people of color don't have democracy. Or when Theodore Allen comes up later on, he comments on how he's growing up in this, not growing up, but he's writing in the 60s, and when white supremacy is being challenged both domestically and internationally. And sometimes these autodidacts really cut through to what's going on, you know, in very precise and insightful ways. I think that's the case with Harrison and with Allen.
I tell you, in the coming months, I would love just to have you back on as a guest to talk about the whole issue of white supremacy, how it's affected the movement for change in this country and split movements apart. It would be, I think we need to be wrestling with that issue, and it'd be great to have you as part of the discussion.
I would love to, and that's one of the other things I speak about, and when I have the long sessions, we get into it very much.
All right, well, we'll do that together.
Yep, and thank you all so very much, too.
It's been a pleasure to meet you on the air.
Right.
Thank you so much, Jeffrey Perry. Great having you here.
Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.
Jeffrey Perry's book, Hubert Harrison, The Voice of Harlem Radicalism, 1883 to 1918. This is the kind of history we need to read because it teaches about where we have to go from here. So stay with us. We'll be right back. We're going to take a little breaking news coming up from the Baltimore Police Department. We'll be talking about, and then talking about a very interesting subject and powerful subject about the straight black world fighting for gay rights. We'll be right back. Stay with us.